good day. We're on the way home. I'll guess to mind, encourage me. I come from a generation where we witnessed, in rural Ireland, where we witnessed our food being provided in our proper means, but slaughtering the poultry was one of them in our presence. And the fox was the enemy of those who raised poultry. And I married a Sligo woman, and this is an observation of a lady in Sligo who was very diligent about rearing turkeys. And it's called the Cadnabonia Fox. Bridie Doherty would treat Huey McCann for Christmas. A plump hen turkey, plucked, dressed, stuffed, the best. For the help with the carvings and the difficult belts. She would treat herself too, a second hen turkey. All season long there would be company for her, the two hen turkeys. McCann would perform the humane slaughter with a lethal twist of a swift wrist, a fatal buckle through flexed knuckle. The end of a season of caring for Bridie, of chuckle and cackle, of buckets and rattle. Her prides from beside her warm fireside, incubating, waiting, graduating. But on the first Sunday of Advent, her grand plan was sundered. A security lapse, a quick bicycle trip to Carlmaiden, and on her return a screeching hen on the lawn. Her heart leapt. The door, I left it ajar. Her turkey's gone and two of her laying hens, a distraught quartet of screeches remain. Turkey feathers strewn, one corpse left hewn at the orchard gate, breast and neck breached by the killer fox's teeth. Her second prize, nowhere to be seen, gone for sure, just like the fox. A blow for Bridie. 60 years of turkey rearing in Tamlashgay, never a lapse to the wily foxes of Cadnabonia until December 2006. McCann was not to know that one was for him. He would seek out and shoot the fox in his den. No, please, Huey, no. Charlie, God rest him, would have not wanted it so.
Thanks very much. Okay, and next up we have the five-word winner, Donna Coogan. Divided between friends in origami folds, so it gets smaller and smaller until it is tiny and sweet. Then we pop it in our mouths, chew it over, and laugh together. And we're off. Car. We're all crammed into the stuffy tin car, best friends and shaking with each other's laughs, missing the views. Where are we now? Who cares? You okay driving, Orla? Yeah. Do you remember Johnner? Yeah! Girl court. Met him last week in Temple Bar, barely recognized him. Is he still at the sideburns? Nah. But he had highlights. Wah! Very coarse. But, and we're off and rolling on the Cork bus. I'm surrounded by Spanish students. Smart driver asks all phones to be turned off. Yeah, right. God, how long is 4 hours? feeling tipsy. Second, can't face family for a whole weekend. I'm getting off at Nana. Make a connection back to Dublin. Way-hey, party. Train. Window seat and table. Room to stretch out. I know the woman opposite wants some company, but I want this couple of hours to myself. Window views changing. Lifts away any sticky thoughts. Coming into Houston, and we're talking about Davy, and listening to her birth story. And I met the doctor going out the door, and I said to him, you better come back in and deliver this baby or else. But the baby was already in my tights. And we're off.
I think that has developed a few fans tonight. And next is another, oh, are you sure?
You were looking at could do with War for Memory, but I don't even know if I could go through it.
If you want to, you don't have to. Go on. Another O'Gale favorite, fabulous woman.
Yes.
Your favourite Valentine's for birthday, but if I forget it, forgive me. You never wore a Sharpie shirt. The anorak was fine. But the day they made the T-shirt, you had to toe the line. Wear suits by Louis Copeland. Endure a station scrub. I know how hard it was for you. An absolute true blue job. So your diction was disturbing. I was totally upset and hoped that you would cling to me despite your Teflon vest. The mattress would be pokey, all those banknotes poking through. But we'd be so good together. And P.S. I love you.
I'm writing a novel at the moment, and it's called The Seventh Gate. It's written in the third person and the story of an artist returns home from exile. But once in a few chapters, a mystery, first person voice surfaces, and this voice kind of ties them all together, ties strands, and it's addressed to a youth, which is not disclosed here. So this is from the Black Notebook. I am, like all of us, the son of an imaginary road. But when I stood 3 paces in front of the man who leaned against the crumbling wall, I was too young to know this. I observed the man closely. His hair was scorched, his nails ablaze, his face a bone-filled parcel. He was a man known by the sun that spit out for the elements to deal with as they please. I remember scrutinizing the details of his face as if he were a mass starvation. The wall he leaned against rose off the ground like the last remaining tooth of a buried skull. I remember laughing. I remember his eyes flickering for a brief moment. If he registered the presence of another human being, was he too far gone? This was the desert, and he and I were the only vestiges of life miles around. How old was I that day, the day I was born fully grown and child man? How old was I the day I was ejected from the infernal hell into life little better? Only God knows. No one ever bothered to tell me my age. I never knew enough to ask. I was a child, a man-child, an old man in a child's body. I longed for you with the body of a man. I loved you with the innocent heart of a child. Even now, 30 years later, I see myself walking away from the scorched man as clearly as it were yesterday. I see him slithering down the wall, a slow montage that haunts me still. Even back then, I knew that man when I saw one. Death was a friend, an ally, and my only comforter. By then I was a full day's walk from my previous existence. I was one day old by my new reckoning. The road was my father, the sky was my mother. Half of what made me lay buried a day's walk to the north. Best of all, the unforgiven was dead. People no longer torment me. When I spared them a thought, it was only in passing. The scorched man, I noticed as I went past, had eyes livelier than the unforgiven's ever were. His eyes were twin bowls of dust that hearkened to emptiness, and it was emptiness now carried with me. A clay bowl waited to be filled with your nectar. A whisper in my ear, I am still. I can hear myself breathe. When I pushed him under, I saw the semblance of life in his eyes. It was just an illusion, of course, no more than the moon's reflection. Addled by drink, he did not resist. He was a spent-up of a man. I remember thinking how strange it was that light shone bright in his eyes, even as that sweet light of his body. It was only the moonlight, of course. I remember my confusion to observe the twin moon shimmer. This had momentarily sent a ripple of fear down my spine. Would he still be alive? This was the very movement of the sentiment of water that covered his semi-submerged, black-jawed face, ebbing and flowing, and giving him the semblance of life. Do you know that dead men tell tales? They do. I hear them. At first, they were no clearer than radio static. They disrupted my dreams with strange noises. Now they transmit their tales in my waking moments. Their voices are loud and clear, viciously clear. Yet I love them. I love them with the love of a man who is back of heart. For they defy me. They are me. I would not be the man I am without them.
Feeling Mary from Sue, one of my favorites. Okay, next we are privileged to have the fabulous famous actress, Rosie O'Regan.
Excuse me, this is pure silly. I've written a haiku.
Right.
And it goes like this. Upon a mountain, nature calls me loud and clear. I crouch to answer. But fate's arthritic hand will have none of it. You, the first item on my beautiful list of heads to go. The imaginary time since bent in twain had no harmony with the higher plan. No twine in the hierarchy, just a strand of its cord. How I wish to save your sweet poise, pulling my voyage into the craggy outliers away from the world. Danger happened to others of them. I, the human, lost my life in rocks. Struggle for survival had to take yours. I can piece together your broken body, shattered with abandoned grief. Now still in my mindless brain box, recording the church music word for word as was played at your funeral. Nothing had translated the cadences of your voice, rising and falling carelessly with a crash. This one is called Too Hard for Winter. I have been as generous like you refused to believe, because you saw me on the inside of all finery. And I'm glad that you got there and not seeing me like this. And I'm glad that you were gone for fear of what you would be. You're not the type I know, but the old women are such traitors. Especially on Saturday night before idlehood. I'm leaving the district for a city of all strangeness, and life is at the same, more or less is here. But the people will be different, and more indifferent, to what to discuss, can discuss at tea break and publish. It's too hard in winter for me to walk down here. The new kinds are all the same, the exact same as those before. You think the same, I'd say, but you never let out. Or some secrets I do to you, I mean to say. I'll see you when I see you, but please God I won't. I'm sick of reading articles, and what we should say. Thanks.
Excellent stuff as usual.
Okay, next up,
Penny
Doyle.
The best call, Penny Doyle. I'm going to try and remember this one. It's about a response about a trip that's very special to me, Samantha. The Ranger Hills where I come from, it's kind of not anywhere, so I'm dealing with that. Samantha. I stood there by my father's side and watched the bright dawn breaking over Valley Larkin. Light streamed low along the lapping river, and Lacey's Hill was its lightest of gold. The moorcock crying on Captain's Pond were amongst matins making holy Samantha, and holier still was the woodcock flying in the white grass above Lacey's steel. A thrush sang psalm through the wires hazel. The yellowing leaves were crisp with frost. Our breath smelled murals in the morning air, and the hawthorn blazed from rocky outcrops. We had come out of the darkness hunting pheasants, but what we found could not be claimed, although it was ours to give forever after, and each giving made it ours again.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Penny. Another tall person is next. Paul Casey.
Oh.
Another best selling in the church. This is called The Scrabble Heads. The Scrabble Heads are melting again, molten in the jugular fires of synonym heaven, caught up in the kaleidoscopic factoring of computers for hours and hours. Wax herms to the tumbling of letters, rooms ablizzard with multicolored memes, erupting combinations never before muttered for hours and hours. Hey, the Scrabble heads are melting again, with some kind of excess mushy pea soup, the ooze dribbling down their chins this time. Imagine onto soggy anthills of half words dumped, yes, for hours and hours, they'll be at it. Yes. Ow, I Ukbar, Fraser Zoo, Monkey Charm, Zimblebox, Seven Worder, softening with exterminable enmities, Ug, Hu, Egg, Ritza, and Z, for hours and hours. Those Scrabble heads, I'll tell you, Scrabbleholics Anonymous needs funding now. Scrabble should be taken in small doses. Tell everyone immediately. And I'm a Scrabble head, by the way. And the poem I haven't read here before, to realize Tommy Frank was coming, he edited a collection in Kerry, called Gifts of Angels. Isn't there a world where the moon blows the clouds and stands, where the wind moves the tides and moods, where the moon sweeps the sun and the dawn sweeper eclipses the street, where the gift of angels is a seedling, not a sea, is of orphan seedlings not in the sea. Isn't there a world?
Gorgeous stuff as usual. Thank you, Paul. Next up we have Christy Parker, the very energetic Christy Parker.
I just listened to Tommy, I wasn't going to read this poem. I'm going to do something I haven't done here before. I'm going to read, I'm going to recite it. I'm not going to look at the work when I'm doing so. But I have it with me here just in case. And I wasn't going to read it, but listen to Tommy, I'll go around his garden and how he lived in London and worked in London. So, well, I did the same actually, because I didn't write books about it. And I worked with a lot of Kerry people as well. She burned my hand with cigarette ash. She said her cousin was in the clash. She lent me money to buy some hash. If you ended up in the crash that night in London town. She said she wanted to sing a band, but she had a child that had been unplanned, and I was lost in all wooden lands. And then she took my hand in the sweet, sweet London town. She stopped her fag on the floor before she reached the pub's front door. Her bouncer whistled and she swore. I knew that there was more in store that night in London town. Out in the cold north London air, the neon lights danced on her hair. There were whores and winos there to spare. Tommy probably knew them all. It began to rain, but we didn't care that night in London town. She gave a beggar 50 pence, and life, she said, would not make sense when all your best is off half pence. A cat was waiting by the fence for us in London town. She tempted our son to see his dad. I wish him, she said, he's a lovely lad. And the heart will say, but night I'm glad, because of the good time that I'd had out there in London town. Everything was going fine, we smoked a joint, we drank some wine, she put our lips closer to mine, and in the morning we were lying in our bed in London town. It said 10:30 on the clock when we heard the policeman's knock. His voice expressed the cruelest shock. Our boy was taken from the lock in cold, great London town. His dad expressed his disbelief the moment he'd lost the muscle or breathe. Life, he said, is just a thief, it is sentenced to me for a lifetime's grief in lonely London town. Forever in my life, she said, it would haunt me in my bed, that we were lying in my bed, when they pulled my only child out dead in cruel, cruel London town. I saw her only once again, her eyes were empty but for pain. She was standing in the rain, and I watched her leaving on the train out of London town. Right. That's the most serious one, okay? This is a poem that I unearthed somewhere today, if I can find it. Yeah, to get to London, in the old days you would have taken a boat, and nowadays you're taking an airplane. That's the theory that Ryanair and Turkey are on the meet and cruise it to board or something, crap like that. Anyway, no matter where we go in the world, they are usually travelled by plane. Hence, this poem is called The Fear. Somewhere locked in your mind lies a deep-rooted dread. It's an ominous shadow that lurks in your head. It's a terror-filled vision that is born as your curse. It's a personal apocalypse that's living next worst. It's a day that lies waiting and is shrouded in gloom. It's the staircase of life that leads to your doom. It's a date with your fate. It's a chill in your spine. It's a nightmare that stares and is called fear of life. High over the Atlantic on a wing of prayer, 50 tons of steel tube are dissecting the air, with a cargo of humans who know not now how, now why, something so bloody heavy can stay up at the sky. At 500 miles of speed past the hour, the four hanging engines that give it its power are held in their places by just bolts and screws, and the computer controls the stratosphere cruise. Then you open your paper and you read at first glance, all aboard believe dead in an air crash in France. Oh, merciful Christ, was a 747, just like the one you're on that took up to heaven. The cause is unknown for the tragic event. Was it hit by a missile? Was it an act of God sent? Did a suicide bomber cause the aircraft to fall? Did a fuel tank erupt and become a fireball? Then the man alongside begins talking to you, and you wonder if he's shitting bricks too. But he just spits it from Cork and he says with a drool, "Do you know what, she's carrying 1,000 gallons of fuel. It's flammable, it's ignitable, it's tenderly divisible, but I believe honestly and the pilot's reliable. After helping the steward before flying planes, he saw taking a cow back in Ukraine." Then a voice comes across him with words that you dread, "Please fasten your seatbelt, turbulence ahead." And a deadly warning puts your future on hold while a deadly dark drama begins to unfold. The tube rattles, it shudders, it dies and it dips. Your heart pounds, your blood drains, your teeth grip your lips. Your stomach is knotted, your pants flood with sweat. As the gods of the sky start to tie with your jet. The floor trembles, vibrates, the lights flicker and dim. As you wait for the sides of the plane to cave in. Your hands clasp the seat, your mouth has gone dry. Literally not by survivors when you fall from the sky. one small crack in the window, just one board to the thin, then you and the rest will be blowing in the wind when you're dying in midair or when you hit the ground. Will they know where you are when your body is found? Someone runs down the aisle, he dives into the toilet. Oh Christ, that looks like a pilot. Just a few moments more and it's in the sky. Oh, we're gonna die! We're gonna die for goodbye! Hello, said the captain, sorry for the delay. Just a few minutes more and we'll be on our way. We'll be cruising today at 2,000 feet. I'm dead, I will ask you to remain in your seat. God, a tarmac delay is like nothing else known. It may be imagination and take all from it, Lord. I won't be here next Sunday, but you can not come along anyway. But there is an open mic tonight in New Orleans, every second Tuesday night, and the next one is tomorrow next week. If anybody's met me by Seaside Town, you can drop in at the Gate Tavern, or the Gate Pub, in South Main Street, from 9:30. But this late is the day.
Thanks very much. What did I tell you? It's an energetic man. And we've got little pieces from Paul and Chris Parker, both the last two readers, have things up here for sale as well. And last but not least, we have the excellent prodigal son, Dahl Harding.
Obviously, last call as well. Okay. And that's up to my brother. We never had any money. And we're all looking for shillings and bobs and coppers and hanners, snippets, halfpennies, pennies, anything. I don't know if you can send it to church, like everybody else. And the local church is called Our Lady of Lourdes. There's a grotto there. And beneath the grotto there's a stream. And the locals coming out of mass just to throw money into the stream. Called Our Lady of Lourdes. We looked up to her, hoping she could not see, and we fished the money from the stream that she was elevated from. On a normal day, the cash might only be a trusty bit or a tanner, but during the mission, at Lent, it was bonanza time. Afterwards, we were compelled to go to confession and say that we had robbed Our Lady. The priest, more often than not, only gave us 3 Hail Marys, probably thinking it was her mother. But it is all under the grotto now, and the stream is dried up. Paul Burger said, there's an old belief in Ireland that somebody dies in a house. The bird comes into the house just beforehand, somebody's going to die. Anyway. Mrs. Kirby said the bird was a portent of death. It flew into her kitchen shortly before the last breath of her father was heard. When I was a young fellow, a swallow announcing spring roared into our glass porch. I was glad to release it to the groggy sky that was here eventually into some new old world. I thought of that bird of death fearing. Was it the wake rat the black cat caught that took him to the edge of the chimney pot? Thank you.